I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk with Danny Aiello. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. For actor Danny Aiello's first real Christmas as a child, he was given a pair of boxing gloves. Somebody had a premonition. While he treasures dignity, Aiello pulls no punches about his life on the streets in New York before unexpectedly becoming an actor at age 37, a great actor in my book. I'm not exaggerating when I say I have seen Moonstruck 10 times, and I could probably do his lines by heart. I won't, because Aiello is a man's man, and he feels like he came off as a kind of wimp as Johnny Camerari. No one would mistake him for a wimp after reading his new memoir, Danny Aiello, I Only Know Who I Am When I'm Somebody Else. Aiello reveals himself as a young street fighter, somebody who robbed cigarette machines and ran numbers for the mob to earn money, and worshipped his mother, who somehow raised a large family pretty much alone. Baseball games in Central Park. That's how Danny Aiello stumbled into acting. Appearing in more than 80 films, he's worked with the best and tried to offer his best, except for that Moonstruck thing, right, Danny?
That's right. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. It's such a great thing to have you on the show. I just love your work.
Well, thank you so much. I truly appreciate it.
This is
Connecticut, isn't it? You broadcast to Connecticut as well?
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to tell you, I was at the Avon Theater in Stamford, Connecticut about a week ago, and prior to that, I was in Greenwich. We were showing a movie that was an animated movie called Henry and Me, about the New York Yankees and the child with catastrophic diseases. I mean, it was wonderful being up there because I hadn't been in Connecticut in quite a number of years, as a matter of fact.
Huh. You know who lives here? Christine Baranski. And you have a great story in your book about stealing her baby.
That is absolutely true, and I hope Christine remembers that this should, because I'm sure it was one of the low points in our life. Her baby was only about a month old, and I made her Broadway debut by taking her out on the stage in a show on Broadway called Hurley Burley. And I asked her, and she never responded, so I accepted that as a yes, if she wanted me to have her baby make the Broadway debut. And I accepted that as a yes. I took her out on the stage about to begin my monologue, and unfortunately, the moment the baby hit the lights, she started to scream at the top of her lungs, that monologue to go through. So naturally, I could hardly say it, so I passed the baby off to Jerry Stiller and him to...
Oh, boy. Oh, of all the people to lose. All right. Hey, Danny, are you there?
Oh, Faith, I'm so sorry. I don't know. I'm in my car actually driving as I'm speaking to you.
So let me.
And I'm sorry we went off the air. Please.
That's okay. Of course. So, Danny, what about this business of the car? I mean, you obviously, you're doing your interview in the car. You say in the book that you do all your preparing and you're rehearsing in the car. How did that start?
Well, Madonna, Sean Penn introduced me to her a long time ago, and I had done that their video with her, Papa Don't Preach. And one time, while we were doing Hurley Burley, Sean and I were doing Hurley Burley in California, and I was invited over to their home in Malibu. And while in her home, she asked me to listen to her album. She wanted to know what my opinion was. The album was the My Prayer album, which is her biggest selling album. So I thought they were going to play it throughout the house in some wonderful system that they might have had. But I'm sitting there comfortably. She takes me by the hand, walks me into the garage, and puts me into her Mercedes and says, this is the only way you should listen to music. And it was in her car. And I was so affected by that I began to utilize my car anytime I was listening to my music, when I was arranging my music, when I was studying a character. Everything I did in my car, as I'm doing right now, speaking to you on this phone, and it's crazy, but that's how it all began.
Is the car moving, or are you just sitting in your garage?
As a matter of fact, I'm sitting outside in, in my beautiful outside my home in Saddle River, New Jersey. I didn't want to sit inside. I'm sitting outside. It's still sun out. I'm sitting with trees all around me.
This is so funny.
It's beautiful.
So do you do all your interviews out there?
No, not really. It's just that I thought this was the most convenient because there's a woman there cleaning up the house right now, and I have my little baby and then my dog. It's Sophie Bell, and she happens to have a habit of barking at everyone and everything. So here I didn't want to be interrupted while I was speaking to you, and then what happens? Naturally, I'm in my car, and we lose.
No,
I'm sorry.
So no, it's okay. So you grew up on West End Avenue, which
I was born West 68th Street. Yes.
Yeah, and that was pretty rough. Your dad was pretty absent. Your mother, I think your mother was not just a saint, but she was a magician. How many people and how many rooms? Was that eight?
Well,
people?
I would say that it was like railroad rooms. It's pretty difficult to determine for you exactly how many rooms there were because they weren't even segregated in the manner which rooms are. It was like you can stay at one end of the apartment and look all the way out the window to the other end of the apartment. You saw all the way through. The only privacy I think that we had truly at that time was a bathroom or a toilet, which was outside in the hallway where other people, other tenants in the building had access to. But otherwise, the amazing thing in my family was that I had four sisters and my mother, of course, and I never saw anyone in the state of undress. I mean, it's an impossible thing to believe, to live in a place like that and never see someone improperly, you know, maybe undressed in that situation. I don't know why I bring that up, but it always befuddled me how that was humanly possible, that there was so much respect that if there was a door, you know, it was always closed if there was a door and there were a couple there. And we would knock before entering. And this, of course, was my mother. It was her behavior, you know.
Yeah.
That's how she was. She would knock at a door before entering into anything. It's amazing as I think about the family and how we were brought up. My father was a nomadic man. We didn't hate him. We loved him because our mother loved him. She never bad-mouthed him. And, of course, all the kids in the family, we couldn't really dislike him because we hardly knew him. He would come home maybe once a year, once every 2 years, and it was sad, you know, and I certainly wanted him to be home more often. But in my opinion, I thought at that time everyone's father was like that. I didn't have anything to compare it to. I didn't know if this other guy I hung out with had a father that was, you know, that as nomadic as my father was. I just didn't know.
Yeah, and I guess part of the time you thought he had maybe a stretch in prison.
Yes, it was a hijacking thing. He was working for a man by the name of Roger Cooey. Roger Cooey was a big Irish gangster, and he was always opposed to Dutch Schultz, who was a Jewish-German gangster from New York City. And they had guys, they weren't mobster guys like my father. My father was like a knock-around guy. In those days, he was a kid. He was about 18. He married my mother when he was 18, and my mother was 15. So he went out, and I think he hijacked something. I remember the first time, you know, I remember my mother taking me to what they called the tombs. The tombs is a place where they place prisoners before going to Rikers Island. So my father was there, and I was 4 years old, and I can remember this vividly. And my mother took me to the tombs, and I couldn't go up to see my father, but the police officer kept me in the vestibule and watched over me while my mother was upstairs. She came downstairs, took me by the hand, walked me out onto the sidewalk and said, look up. I looked up at what was the fourth floor. There were bars in the window, but I couldn't see anything. So she took my hand again and took me out into the street and said, look up again. I looked up and I saw a Zippo, flash of a Zippo lighter. That was my father signaling me from up at the fourth floor. And I don't know the last time I saw him after that. It could have been maybe a year later. I'm not sure. But It was something that I remembered for even up until now very vividly because of father, you know, lighting the lighter from a jail cell.
Yes.
Letting his son know that he was there. Maybe the sign was that. Because my mother must have said, your dad's telling you how much he loves you, you know. Something like that.
Yeah. It's a very touching scene in the book, and to hear you tell it also the same. So you'd seen your father, you know, probably kids know so much, you know. We think we don't know, but we do. And so then you yourself started running numbers for the mob just to get some money in the house, right?
And remember, at this time when I was doing that, we can't call it running numbers. I don't know if that's the proper terminology, but there was what they called a bookie in the neighborhood, and they would get kids to do it. Maybe I could have been 12, 13, 14 years old at the time, and we were living not down in Manhattan, and we were living up in the Bronx on Stebbins Avenue. And we couldn't get locked up. The police would never grab a kid and lock him up, so they would use us to carry the money and to take the bets from the people. You have to keep in mind that at that time, if you've got a quarter, you were able to make a couple of $100. So people who are so very poor in that area, their only surprise in life could be if they hit a number. So naturally, they'd find quarters, dimes, and they would place bets and pray each day that they did a number. I guess it's like gamblers today, but on a much smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
And people are not gambling because they wanted to gamble. It's just they needed money.
Yeah.
And I'm not justifying what I did. I made a couple of bucks. It wasn't much. And the big thing is someone hit a number with you, they gave you a big tip. You know, if you placed the bet for them. And what we did, we ran the numbers up to Fordham Road, around Fordham Road in that particular area, and gave it to the bookie. All the numbers and the money, and then we just left, and that was it.
So then there was the period. I'm focusing on the bad stuff that you did, just because
yeah.
It's such an amazing contrast to how your life went as soon as you had a chance. You know, so it was breaking into cigarette machines to get some money, and
that was so silly. I mean, when you think of it, babe, you know. At this time, I was breaking into those things younger and older. And there was a time when I was breaking into places, you know, places that did not have people in them, just machines. And it could have been a bowling alley. We'd see a cigarette machine, a Coke machine. There was no cash in the place. So we would take out, we'd break open the machines and take out quarters and dimes. I was paying my rent for months. My wife, when I would maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd be home with rolls of dimes and quarters. She said, "Where'd you get that?" She thought I was shooting pool, because I was a pool hustler at the time too, as a young kid. So we would pay rent, and my wife never suspected it, because I said, "Well, I was shooting pool. I want some money." But
wow.
That's what we were doing it for. I wasn't doing it for self-aggrandizement. I wasn't looking to buy myself anything. You had to pay the rent, and I paid the rent the only way I know how. And I'm not justifying that. If I would have gotten caught, I would have taken my punishment as I should have, because what I was doing was wrong. It was terrible. There was no excuse. But I did it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something I admitted in the book.
Yeah, I know. I appreciated how honest you were in your book. So stay where you are, Danny Aiello, and we're going to come right back and talk more about some of the stories you tell in your memoir, and we're going to open the phones here on the show. Danny Aiello is our guest, and we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton with actor and singer Danny Aiello. You have likely seen him in some great films, The Godfather, Moonstruck, Fort Apache, Purple Rose of Cairo, Do the Right Thing, Madonna's music video, Papa Don't Preach, The Last Don miniseries. Just millions of people watch that. So Danny Aiello has written a memoir, and it is fascinating reading. I read it over the weekend. I could not put it down. It's called Danny Aiello, I Only Know Who I Am When I'm Somebody Else. So Danny, the amazing thing is that you're playing baseball in Central Park with, you know, these leagues that are playing around the park. And you hook up with one in particular, and that was your way in, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had a job. It was probably the most outstanding job I'd had. I was elected president of Division 1202 of the Amalgamated Transit Union at the Greyhound Bus Company in New York City. unfortunately, I lost that job as a result of a Wildcat strike. And I was sort of floundering around, not knowing what I was going to do, because I was sued for $500,000, which, of course, was dropped later when I indicated that I had no intention of trying to come back. I became somewhat disillusioned because I felt that the union that was supposed to be backing me went with management. And I became so disillusioned at that time that I lost track of just about everything, and including getting another job. So I'm floundering around. I walk into a place called The Improvisation in New York City, a famous, famous comedy club where all the greatest comedians began and worked through. The proprietor of that place was Bud Friedman, who still owns many improvisations throughout the country, L.A., Las Vegas. So he looked at me. He knew that I was a ball player, so I didn't know if he was going to offer me a job as a result, you know, of me being able to play ball, because he wanted me to be a ringer on his improvisational softball team in the Broadway Show League, or that he felt bad that I had four children and needed a job. And in any event, he gave me the job, and that's where it all began. That's where my life as an actor I had no thought of becoming an actor when I went in there. I never thought the possibility of becoming an actor. I thought that was people that came from Mars or lived in California, the same thing, I guess. But it just wasn't me. But there I was. A guy walks over to me one day, and he says, his name is Louis LaRusso II, near Fight Right, and never produced anything, said, I'd like you to do my play. I said, I'm not an actor. He said, yes, you are. You just don't know it yet. Now, he gathered that information by watching me MC occasionally. I was a bouncer at The Improvisation, but at times I would be an MC when Bud Friedman wasn't MCing. So he saw me on the stage, and so help me God, I wasn't doing much. I was just announcing people coming up, so I certainly wasn't glib. I certainly wasn't a comedian.
Well,
what did he do? He offered me this thing, and before you know it, he had written me three plays that were off Broadway, and each one of them ended up on Broadway.
Isn't that
something? So it was an amazing happening.
Yeah, really something. I mean, he'd probably seen you crack a few skulls in the club.
I hit one guy. I hit one guy, and it was Maya Lindsay's man, because he was insulting a comedian by the name of Cassandra Danza.
Yeah, so you messed him up pretty good, it seems like. Godfather Part 2. Can you tell about, first of all, I didn't know, you describe how, you know, for that strangling, they've got some kind of a harness on him so that you can lift him and make it look real. And then what was the line you said?
Well, Michael Gazza was the actor. The character's name was Piantangeli, and I was supposed to choke him. I come in, I put a harness around his back. It appeared as if it was around his neck. I lift him out of the bar and take him into a phone booth about 30 feet away. We were rehearsing the scene. I had no line whatsoever. So when I came in, I lifted him up, and I said, Michael Corleone says hello. And Francis Coppola said, what did the director? He said, what did you say? Now I'm intimidated. This is Francis Coppola, and here I am improvising a stupid line. I'm not even sure to this day what it meant. He said, what did you say? And I said, well, I think I said, Michael Corleone says hello. He said, good.
And kept it in.
It turns out to be a line, you know, which was totally improvised and not in the script that everyone on the internet seems to be asking questions about. And they all come up with definitive answers, with the exception of me. I still don't know what it meant.
Well, you know, yeah. What's intriguing about you delivering that line is this natural ability that you had right from the start to act.
Yeah. You know something, Faith? I used to consider that an insult by critics at the beginning of my career. They were always praising me, so I felt good about that. But they used to call me, I was unlearned, with the exception of now, because when they say I'm a natural now, that feels good because I know what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I had no idea what I was doing at the beginning. It was pure energy. God knows I was lucky to be able to construct a sentence properly at that time. I thought energy, energy, energy. That's the thing that'll get you by, Danny, and it worked for me. until I realized later, like, geez, there's more to acting than just, you know, showing energy. And I began to become a little smarter. And then when they said natural at that time in my career, I felt good about it.
Well, you say in the book, I'm quoting you, I've always tried to connect my acting to my street upbringing. I employed the same instincts on the stages of Broadway and in film that I used growing up in the Bronx.
Yes, and that totally, that was like a simple recall of different situations that I've been in and how I reacted to those situations. And I placed that kind of attitude into the movies that I was done. Every movie that I've done, I've sort of experienced that kind of thing or that kind of scene in any of the movies that I did that I've had in life. And I knew the way I reacted to it. And that's what they call natural. I just tried to utilize my imagination. How would I react to something that's coming at me like this? And I had total recall. I was able to utilize my imagination. I don't know at the beginning if it had any intelligence, you know, because like I said before, it was purely energy. But as time went on, you know, I just tried to imagine the situation. There's no great secret to it. You know, everyone has their own way of doing it when they're acting. My way is to be as natural as it's humanly possible to be. And that's what I've done on the screen, and that's the reaction that I generally get from critics.
Well, you certainly, growing up, had maybe some encounters with these made guys, you know, in the mob. And so I was interested when you said in the book that, of course, the Godfather movies are fables.
Yeah.
And that these made men don't talk like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always thought, you know, there were two situations I felt that about fairy tales, I call the term. I don't know if it's a proper term, but it's something that's not real, that we don't see in life. And to me, they were like Shakespearean characters, and I think that's what his intention was. I'm talking about Francis Coppola. And in the same token, I think Spike Lee, I thought Do the Right Thing was like a fable. And it was to me, because in that particular neighborhood where we shot Do the Right Thing, there was a lot of bad things. There wasn't a place that you couldn't.
I think that's right about Do the Right Thing. I mean, I agree with you. It was like an opera.
Yeah, it wasn't real in life. But then I realized that what he was doing, I'm talking about Spike Lee, the director, it was a political interview, and that's what he tried to put over. I didn't realize that at the beginning. I thought he was talking about total reality because there was no drugs involved in it, and that's what he wanted. He wanted people, if there was race-related problems, he wanted to be not as a result of people taking drugs and being affected by that. You know, he wanted people to be clear of mind, and if they had a race problem, they had that race problem clear of mind.
And you, he asked you to do a part in this movie about 100 times, and he whined and dined. He practically married you to get you to do this. So finally, you say yes, but you insisted that, you know, as the pizza guy in the movie, you had him say a certain thing. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, when I first read, I opened up the script and it said pizza man, and I got the opinion that he had me flipping pizzas in the air, and I thought, if you wanted to use the term racial, I thought that was it. I looked at Spike, and you know, we're very good friends, and I said, Spike, this is tantamount to what if I offered you something called watermelon man, you know, and he understood what I said, and it's a term that was used quite a number of years ago. And pizza man, watermelon man, it's the same thing, one fitting an Italian and one with the slang that people use fitting a black man. And he understood what I was saying. I said, look, the script is good, but I think that my character is not, it's not fulfilling to me. If you don't allow me to have some significant input. Now, lo and behold, I didn't know that he allows all of his actors in his pictures to bring themselves to the part, even suggest lines, and he'd use them if he thought they were right. So he said, yes, absolutely go. So I invented a lot of this stuff. I did the speech when I said, I built this place with my bare hands, every light's fire. That was nasty. Then there was one particular line that was quoted by every critic imaginable when I said, these people grew up on my food. And that one line, I think that one line was probably the reason why I got nominated for the Academy Award. And keep in mind that I thought that was a corny line. 5 minutes before I shot it, I said, "Are you sure you want this line I wrote?" Because he said, "No, keep it in." Because I thought it was corny, but he said, "Keep it in." Mm. So he was the one that allowed that line and others
wow.
to stay in the script.
Wow, isn't that something? Well, that's true collaboration, huh? Danny Aiello is my guest. He has a memoir out, just out. It's called I Only Know Who I Am When I'm Somebody Else. And we're going to talk with him about his singing. You're going to hear some of that right now. We'll be right back.
Every time it rains pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? You'll find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down. Come on and trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, you must have showers. So when you hear it thunder, don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you, pennies from heaven for me, pennies from heaven for you and me.
I'm Faith Middleton, and I would like to thank our producers, Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. My guest is actor and singer, Danny Aiello. He has done a memoir. It's just out. I Only Know Who I Am When I'm Somebody Else. We now have you on a landline, I understand.
Faith, I apologize.
That's
I'm
okay.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay, my friend. Here you are. So there's a part in your book where you say, I swore that I was through reading for parts. And you said the simple truth is that you didn't want to audition truly because you couldn't stand the rejection.
Yes. It's a rejection that all my life I felt inhabited me. Let me go as far back as school. If there was a school dance, I would never go over and ask a girl for a dance in fear of my being rejected. I simply couldn't accept it. And I think this goes all the way back to the age of 6 when I was in school, and I felt I was rejected as a result of having eczema, sitting in the front row in the seat where the teacher loved me. I was a skinny little kid who paid attention a lot. But I also had a scratch like crazy, and I would rip myself apart, and other people would look at me, other kids, and look at me, I thought, with disgust and sort of rejected me as a result of that. So I didn't have too many friends in school. I was left back twice, hospitalized as a result of that disease. And there I was, 2 years older than the kids who were in the same class as I, and I felt I was rejected there, and I think it's something that grew with me forever and stayed with me to this day. I'm never, so you know, people look at me and they say, oh, God, this guy's so self-assured. Now, I don't know what the hell it is. When I walk into a room, people say, oh, God, he walks in like he owns the place. As God is my witness, I tell you the truth, Faith. I am so, when I walk into a place that's loaded with people, I look for a corner and I sit down and just observe people, and I'm as shy as it's humanly possible to be. And I think this all stems from my youth and just continued on throughout my life. It's just that it's like a plague with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I always felt to go in there, if someone asked me to read, what was I going to do in the reading? I'm going to get a part. No, I always thought that a part was given as a result of what one has done in the past or what one physically looks like, not as a result of any reading that they give.
And so you thought that Norman Jewison was making you read for a part, but he was really trying to get a feel for his script.
Yes.
And so that was, but what's interesting about Moonstruck for you, you know, you say you were afraid you came off as wimpy as Johnny Camerari.
Yes.
I thought you were genius in that movie because you could have gone for laughs because this was your first comedy and you just played it so straight and it was so incredible.
Thank you.
As a character, honestly.
I went through the neighborhood I lived in at the time. You don't play a wimp in a movie because they'll look to smack you or insult you in some way, because they have a way of interpreting what you're playing as the character that you truly are. Uh-huh. They knew better than that, of course. But then, you know, I didn't want my mother to see it because of being such a wimp. But as I look at it now, I realize what it did for me. They thought that, you know, like you said, I wasn't trying to crack jokes or anything like that, but I was amusing. And it certainly put me in a different pay category as a result of showing producers, you know, that I can be funny in a situation. And it just raised the level of what I was getting paid.
Listen, I've got to ask you one question, and then I swear I'm getting off Moonstruck.
Okay.
But you know the scene, who plays... The Olympia Dukakis's husband.
His name. Oh God, it's going to kill
me. Vince?
His name is on.
Gardenia.
No.
No.
Yes. Oh, Vincent.
Vincent Gardenia.
I thought you meant the uncle of.
No.
No, Vincent Gardenia was my mentor, one of the great people of all time.
Oh my God! So there's that scene in Moonstruck where he and I want to know, was this Norman Jewison or was this Vincent Gardenia doing this? You know the scene at the table at the end.
And when he hit the table.
Unbelievable. So what did he dream that up? And he doesn't say a word. I have seen this at, you know, I grew up kind of in an Italian family. I have seen that scene where not a word is said. The hands on the table.
Yeah.
The standing up, it was so amazing.
It was all Vincent. Although Norman had come up with some wonderful suggestions, he's a great director from Canada, as you know, but that was Vincent. May I tell you a brief story about Vincent?
Yeah.
My first movie, Bang the Drum Slowly, he's playing the coach, I'm playing the first baseman. I was out there somewhat intimidated. I'm with De Niro, Michael Moriarty, they're all in the movie, Phil Foster, Vincent Gardenia. I'm in the corner with my uniform on, and I'm mumbling to myself. I had about 8 lines in the movie, first movie, and I'm mumbling, trying to find a way to say properly these lines. Vincent Gardenia walks over. He said, "What's the matter, kid?" I said, "Well, Mr. Gardenia, I'll tell you. I'm having great difficulty trying to figure out exactly how to say these lines. You know, I've realized that if I say these lines and they're terrible, well, if I see the movie 50 times, I'm going to be terrible 50 times." He looks at me and says, "Don't worry, kid. You're probably never going to work again anyway." That was Vincent. He's the greatest guy, and we became great friends. Of course, he was joking, and naturally, I did work together.
Yeah, and you say that he could just crack you up whenever you worked together.
He used to cook me macaroni without salt because he was diabetic. He didn't use salt. I said, "You cannot make macaroni without salt. You just can't do it. There's no taste to it." And he didn't understand it. He tried different ways to make it taste good, but I always felt without salt, forget about it. But he is a great man. May he rest in peace. He really was.
Yeah. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to open the phones and give other folks a chance to talk with you about your new memoir, Danny Aiello, I Only Know Who I Am When I'm Somebody Else. It's just out. Our number is 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR. So I kept going back to this part in your memoir and saying, am I reading this right? Were there times, and was Robert De Niro there too, were there times when they would beat people up at the theater?
There were times. Robert wasn't there. That was in a play called... Lamppost Reunion. It was my first play on Broadway. And there were guys blackjacking a guy and carrying him out. And he was one of the actors that was expected to be on the stage in the next scene. I can't mention his name, but it was terrible. He was creating problems with drugs and so forth. And the producers of the show thought that he was going to sink the show. So they removed him. Now, I thought this was a common practice. It was similar to the streets because that was my first play. So I wasn't able to attach myself to what was happening. So I guess this is the way they get rid of somebody.
Really? Well, I mean,
it was the most ridiculous thing. And, you know, there's a lot of arguments that take place in egos on stage plays, especially.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen too often in motion pictures because there's so many people around. But things occur on a live stage, which, if you're going to act, is the best place to do it on the stage. The immediacy of it is great, Faith. The response is great from an audience, especially when they like you. And but there are, you know, there are things that happen between actors on a stage where when the curtain falls down, there's punches thrown. Absolutely, absolutely, happens often.
So punches thrown.
Yeah.
So well, no punches thrown with you and Lauren Bacall. But there's a story in here where I thought, oh, this must have been bad for you to for this to go in the book.
Yes, I must tell you that this, of course, happened before the passing of Ms. Bacall, who. At one point in my life, I loved. We were friends, and we end up in this movie together, Prêt-à-Porter, which is Ready to Wear. We're shooting in France, and there were about 200 people. And out of nowhere, I'm again mumbling in the corner by myself as I did and bang the drum slowly, just trying to remember lines that we didn't have because Robert Altman had scripts with no lines, and you developed your own characters. All he told you was you were hated. You were hated, you're a buffoon, you're a bull in a china closet, and then you have to invent the words that this particular
wow.
character has to say. So I'm in the corner mumbling words, improvisational words to myself, very low, and suddenly I hear, why don't you shut? There were a couple of words behind it. I didn't know where it was coming from or who it was intended to be for. I looked up, and she's looking at me. And I responded in kind. And just as she said to me, I responded, who are you talking to? And people came to her aid, Rupert Everett came. He looked at my eyes. I was playing a Jewish character. He looked at my eyes, and he said to me, don't look at me with those mafia eyes. I said, I'm not Italian, I'm Jewish. He said, oh, yeah. And I said, yeah, this Jew is going to get down and kick you. And he disappeared for 2 weeks. And then Stephen Ray, he put his hand on me. They were defending her. And I can understand that to a degree, but I was so hurt by what she said to me in front of all of those people that I resorted to the street. Now, let me say I hated myself after I did it.
Yeah.
I went back to my room. I called my wife. I said, I'm coming home in the Concorde tomorrow. Why? What's the matter? I did this stupid thing. I feel terrible and so forth and so on, the words that I said to Lauren Bacall. And they talked me out of going, and they told me to stay. And lo and behold, the next day, I thought I was hated by all the models in the movie, everyone in the movie. I began to get, I don't drink, but I was getting bottles of wine, champagne, flowers, telling me how happy they were because of what I did. And that was answer back, Miss Bacall, may she rest in peace. Apparently, she wasn't well liked, and it certainly wasn't because of her acting ability or anything like that. But she had a way about her that some people were turned off.
Well, it's quite a scene where everybody starts fighting. You know, it was like an infection that goes roaring through. You know, everybody starts going after everybody. And
you
so,
know, had I known, let me put it this way, forgive me, you know, I feel terrible about this because I loved our son, Sam. We were good friends. And I even said in the book, if he punched me right in the mouth, he was there at the time, I would have accepted and walked away as being the one who was wrong to have done what I did. I never would have put this story in had Lauren passed away prior to my book being written. I just simply would not have done it. So I sit here telling you how sorry I am that I even entered it into it. But like I said, I took the rap. I was the one. I resorted to the street. I shouldn't have done it. And I can't apologize enough.
Well,
that thing happening.
You know, Danny, this raises this is Danny Aiello, the actor and singer. This raises the issue of, I mean, it's a very candid look at not only your life, but what goes on behind the scenes. And so I appreciated that so much. The stories were really great and interesting. And, you know, and I thought at the end, now, why is it important? Why was it important for you to tell this story? What do you think is at the root of this for you?
To see, even at that grown age that I happen to be at, the many years that I've been in show business at that point, that you never lose who you are to begin with. And who I was to begin with was a street kid. And a kid who would get in fights because he was unable to beat another person verbally, when the person who was able to speak well was cutting me up and I lost words, I would end up fighting it. This only showed that here's a grown man with a woman.
Oh.
You got to keep in mind that five women, I was nurtured by five women. I've never spoken that way to a woman in my life.
Yeah. Oh, but I mean in the bigger picture, not just the Bacall story. I mean, why did you write this memoir? What do you think this is about for you, telling these stories at this stage?
I wanted to serve as an inspiration to other people who had maybe gone through a lot of garbage in their life and thought that their life was over. I'm talking about people who are never in trouble, may have a job. I'm talking about them as well, who may have a job and think, oh, I'm 46 years old, and here I've lost this job, and there's nowhere for me to go, or I'm 40 years old, I'm 36. I just wanted them to serve as inspiration that I could go all through this, and at the age of 36, change my life so completely. And how completely? I suddenly became an actor at the age of 36. At the age of 40, I did my first motion picture, and I've made 90 movies. Just to point out, I thought that my story could serve as an inspiration to people who may want to further their life beyond what they have been in the past, maybe better themselves. And I think I have. I think had this not come along, my feeling is that I would have ended down the wrong path, the path that I had begun on, and that path was definitely on its way to jail or death.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of great things that I did also that I didn't do. Things that actors have done for years, taking drugs and things of that nature, drinking. You know, I've never done any of those things. And here I want to prove to kids who may be out there as an actor that you don't have to be a drug-laden person to become an actor. They think so many of our great actors have died as a result of utilizing drugs, that they think, well, in order to be that great, you have to utilize drugs. Well, you'll also die if you do. I'm saying that I've become somewhat famous, somewhat celebrity-like, somewhat successful, and never touched a drug in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Not pot, not coke, not anything. And as a matter of fact, if I may tell you, if you don't do that, well, in the 70s, this was true. If you didn't do drugs, you might not get as many movies as you thought you'd get.
Oh, wow. That's something.
I tried to put that into the book in a very disguised way because I couldn't accuse anyone of doing that. But I wanted people to know that it was so prevalent in the business that if they knew you were clean, it would be very difficult for them to work with you. I'm not talking, they don't do drugs during work. It's when you're off hours and you all get together. People who do drugs do not want to be around the person who's not doing it, period.
Yeah, of course. So we've got John on the line. John, welcome to the show. We have actor and singer Danny Aiello. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Danny.
Hello, John.
It's Omar. Years ago, I was a young camera operator in New York, and you came to a place called Unitel to do some promos for a show called Gemini you were in.
Wow. That was a long time ago. You remember that commercial? That was the first commercial done for a stage play. A
That's
Broadway
right.
play, and I think I yelled out, hey, it's going to be some party. That was the line I had.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's what I remember really quickly. We both decided we were going to work very close to the camera, which freaked out everybody there, and there were a bunch of bigwigs in the room. And you kept going over and over your lines, and you said, oh, sorry, John, I missed that, John. Let me do it one more time, John. And you wouldn't speak to anybody in the room except for me, and I was just amazed.
Oh, that's how I'm very dedicated to the person who's calling the shots, John.
Yeah, thank you, John. Yeah. Thanks for your comment.
Thank you very much.
Great, Danny. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
So, Danny, I was so interested that when you were doing the Jackie Chan movies,
yes.
that all those effects— Those stunts are all real? I mean...
Oh, yes. I never have seen my stunt. You know, I lost my son, Danny, his third, to pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
Danny did over 300 movies, and it frightened me every moment that I was there to see anything that he had done.
Because he was a stunt man.
Yeah, a stunt man and then stunt coordinator. When I saw Jackie, and I'm looking at him, he's fighting 250 feet above my head up on this little plank with this big Chinese fellow, and they're fighting, and the Chinese fellow is tied down. He has something wrapped around him. In case he falls, he's going to be caught. But Jackie's freely going over the thing. I went crazy when they came down. I said, Jackie, what the hell are you doing? He said, I owe it to my fans, in broken English. He spoke very little English. I said, the hell with you. Are you crazy? They can't see the... If you have a lifeline around you, they can't see that. He said, yeah, but I know it. And I just can't do it. He has about 200 stuntmen on the set with him. If one gets hurt, one goes to the hospital, the other one takes over. Another one goes to the hospital, the other one takes over.
Wow.
They do real stuff. I've never seen, they like climb walls. It's like the most incredible thing I've ever seen. But I was always, always leery about Jackie really hurting himself badly. And he's still doing it, God bless him. I don't know how the hell he can do it.
Wow. You were saying, you know, if you were smashed in the head with a telephone, it was a real telephone. It was really smashing somebody.
In the head with a telephone. I thought it was a breakaway. It didn't break. It was just a telephone hitting the guy. And the guy took it without a problem.
So let me say something. There is a movie of yours that I know not many people saw, because when it came out, 9/11 had happened. And, of course, that was the end of it. But I saw it and loved it. So if people have Netflix, go and watch Dinner Rush. This was directed by Bob Giraldi, who is just a genius, and I know you think so too. And you are fantastic in that movie. So,
thank you. I love that movie, and it's true. It happened at 9/11. Not too many people have seen it. However, it's a cult movie on TV.
It's a food movie. It's just terrific.
You will leave there hungry. And it's really it's a sweet story. It's a very hip story. It's probably one of the best eating pictures that I've ever seen.
I know.
Kind of pictures.
Hey,
next
Danny.
To the big knife.
I know. I know that's true. Danny Aiello, thank you so much for being on the show. You're a great guy.
I truly appreciate, and I listen to NPR all the time. I want you to know that.
All right, we're going to listen to you right now. As always, this show's about the richness of life. Danny Aiello's memoir, I Only Know Who I Am When I'm Somebody Else. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.